Okay, good evening. Our topic for tonight is classical Reform Judaism. Classical Reform Judaism, yes. Different from Neo-Reform, which we will speak about next week. All right. We ended off last time with the Trefa Banquet of 1883. The graduating class of Hebrew Union College, the first graduating class. They became rabbis and they ate treif. Not chazer, there was no pork, but there was non-kosher, and it led to a little bit of a brouhaha between the traditionalists or the middle-of-the-roaders who had been supportive of the Hebrew Union College project and everyone else who was less pious and less interested in ceremonial religion. So tonight we're going to focus on the period of time between 1883 and 1885, and then a little bit beyond that, but really the key moment are the mid-1880s.
So that treif banquet was lahachas, right?
No, I would say it wasn't lahachas. I say it was inadvertent. It was in the sense that Jewish eating practices among non-Orthodox Jews in the Midwest was that you don't eat pork, but everything else is fair game. And the caterer didn't realize that for this particular event, maybe there should be an elevated standard of actual kosher, and so he served whatever he normally would have served, and it offended people who didn't like that. Yeah. It wasn't even kosher style. It was outright treif. It just didn't have pork. That's it. So.
But the shellfish.
Shellfish, correct. Yes. Okay. So the Reform movement in this period of time needed to distinguish itself from the ethical culture movement and from Unitarian Christianity. Reform needs to affirm some positive set of beliefs and give itself a purpose. Why should it exist at all? In light of the fact that there are other movements that seem to have the same ethical values and don't have Jewish particularism. So, the two leading figures of this era are the two sons-in-law of David Einhorn, the radical. And they are Kaufmann Kohler and Emil G. Hirsch. Kohler, born in Germany, a disciple of Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, gets his doctorate, biblical criticism in 1868, comes to America in 1869, is a rabbi in Detroit for a few years, and is a rabbi at Congregation Sinai in Chicago, then the rabbi of Bethel, succeeding his father-in-law in 1879 after Einhorn's death, where he remains until 1903 when he becomes the president of Hebrew Union College, and then dies in 1926.
Of
Hirsch.
Hirsch. And when did he?
In his 20s, he had a falling out with Orthodoxy. But an epiphany of some kind, yes. Emil Hirsch, by contrast, grew up in Luxembourg, was born in 1851. His father was the chief rabbi of Luxembourg, then moves to Philadelphia when his father, Samuel Hirsch, becomes the rabbi of Knesset Israel, succeeding Einhorn at Knesset Israel, and goes to University of Pennsylvania, goes to Europe for his rabbinical training, and comes back and becomes the rabbi of Sinai in Chicago, where he's there for half a century and is the most prominent Reform rabbi in America.
Jews could go to the University of Pennsylvania at the end of the 19th century.
Yeah. Okay. So there's no clear dividing line, chronologically, between the classical Reform period and the neo-Reform period. It blends one into the other, and for different characters, the latter era begins earlier rather than later. And we'll have to examine what are the differences between the methods and beliefs of Reform Judaism in the earlier and later periods. The classical Reform viewpoint is best expressed in the Pittsburgh Platform, which we'll discuss tonight. That platform left the Reform movement less internally divided between moderates and radicals, because the radicals win, and everybody has to become radical, but it makes them further away from the rest of world Jewry. In other words, if Isaac Meir Wise wanted to have an American Judaism that was basically a Reform Judaism but could encompass almost all American Jews, well, that's not going to work. Why? Because Reform is going to become radical, and you either get with the program or you get out. And everyone else who doesn't get with the program is going to be much more traditional in practice and in belief than will be the official institutions of Reform. So in-house, they're now united, but they're 1,000 miles away from all other Jews. Okay. So let's get to the ethical culture angle. Felix Adler, who I mentioned last time, was the son of Samuel Adler, who was the rabbi of Emmanuel. And Felix was supposed to replace his father upon his father's retirement. He goes off to Berlin to study at the Hochschule, and he gets his rabbinical degree. But upon his arrival in New York, gives a sermon which was so out there, so extreme, that even the laity of Temple Emmanuel couldn't tolerate it and said, "Son, get out of the rabbinate." And so he did. And he established the New York Society for Ethical Culture.
What did he say in that sermon?
You know, there's a dispute as to what he said. It's unclear. There's no written record of it. But it was dismissive of the survival of Judaism as a distinct religion. It wasn't dismissive of the values of Judaism, but rather of the survival of particularistic religion of Judaism. So he felt that Jews had to drop all particularism, and he accused Reform Judaism of being a halfway house between untenable orthodoxy and complete liberation. Untenable orthodoxy, meaning there's no going back to traditionalism, and complete liberation, which is what he wants. So Reform Judaism is neither here nor there. Okay, it's not for him.
Is there still God in this?
No. God is out of the picture. He considered Reform Jews to be hardly Jews at all. But what he realized is that the Reform Jews refused to recognize that fact and take the final step beyond particularism. Basically, his criticism of Reform is similar to the criticisms of Reform that are opined by Orthodox rabbinical figures, that Reform Jews, who are not ritually observant and are not believers in classical doctrine, basically aren't Jews anymore. I don't mean by ethnicity or by nationality, but by religion, they're not Jews anymore, by their own choice, except that they refuse to recognize that choice. That's Adler's criticism, to which, of course, the others in the Reform camp would, you know, vigorously defend themselves and deny that he's right. Okay. Isaac Mayer Wise recognized the threat posed by Adler's ethical culture. And Wise was always one with a good pithy statement, a good zinger, to assault his opponent. And he said, "There is no God, and Felix Adler is his prophet."
Okay.
Was it necessary to have that divider, the central part, the ethical culture in the West?
Well, I think you're onto something. They needed the half a mile distance in order to not get into a fight. Of course, Spanish Portuguese moved right next to ethical culture. So, Kaufmann Kohler was challenged by some of his detractors with the claim that Kohler's ideas about religion basically lead in the same direction as Felix Adler, except that he refuses to admit it. That whereas Adler abolishes Jewish ceremonialism and traditional doctrine and says, "I'm not Jewish anymore," Kohler does the same thing but says, "No, Judaism will survive and I'm a rabbi. And I'm in the business of Judaism." He denied that. He said, no, my beliefs don't lead in the same direction as Felix Adler. I'm still within the camp of Judaism. All right, fine. In 1885, Alexander Kohut arrives from Hungary. He was a big scholar, had learned in the traditional yeshivas in Hungary, and he became the rabbi at Avos Chesed in New York, which was a moderate Reform synagogue. And he gave lectures in the German language on Pirkei Avos throughout the summer of 1885. He gave the Perek Shir throughout the summer. And he espoused the golden mean of Judaism and said that law and not spirit is the unalterable basis of Judaism. So here he's a new arrival saying that we have to maintain historical continuity in our religious practices, and that radical changes, sudden radical changes, and the abolition of all sorts of Jewish ceremonies and practices is not the right way. So who is he attacking? He's attacking Kaufmann Kohler, who's the rabbi of Bethel, just a few blocks away. So Kohler responds with a series of lectures at Bethel, and it is claimed that 1,000 people attended some of these lectures. So although you have two non-Orthodox rabbis duking it out over what is Judaism, each one of them espousing something which is not traditional, but one being much more not traditional than the other, at least on the one hand, it got rid of apathy and indifference. People who were not especially into Judaism came to listen to rabbis talk about Judaism. That is interesting. I mean, it doesn't happen much anymore. But when was the last time there was a theological debate or series of competing lectures in the non-Orthodox world that were attended by 1,000 people? It hasn't happened in 100 years, and it isn't going to happen again. All right. So from this debate, it became clear that Reform Judaism needed to have a positive self-definition, which was to the left of Alexander Kohut's positive historical Judaism, but to the right of Felix Adler's ethical culture. And so a gathering was convened at Pittsburgh. Isaac Meir Wise decided to show up, which was a risky political move, because he knew full well that this was going to be a radical convention, much more so even than Philadelphia in 1869, and certainly much more so than the Reform conventions in Germany in 44 through 46, that very serious departures from tradition were going to be promulgated here. And he runs a risk that if he participates in this, and he's the big macher of Hebrew Union College and Union of American Hebrew Congregations, that traditional or quasi-traditional Jews will abandon the college and the union in protest of his radicalism or his association with radicalism. So he runs a risk of going, but he goes because he can't be away from the scene. You know, he has to be at the center of the action. Yeah. He's made the honorary president of this conference, despite the fact that his viewpoints are not going to be the ones that are adopted, in deference to his position as the grandpa, the chief grandpa of American Reform. And so the eight points in the platform are written almost entirely by Kohler. The last one was written by Emil Hirsch, which we'll see differs from all the others in its focus on pre-messianic times and improving the world. Okay, Kohler emphasized at this convention that Reform Judaism needs to do something to eliminate the popular notion that Reform are just a bunch of rebels and traitors. Those are his exact words. I'm not making up those words. Those are his exact words. That there's the viewpoint that Reform rabbis are rebels and traitors to the cause.
Who was this again? This
was Kaufman Kohler. Yes. Okay. So let us take a look at what it says. And there'll be some overlap from what we read last time from Philadelphia in 1869, but there are some noticeable differences. Let's see. In the view of, the preamble says like this, in the view of wide divergence of opinion of conflicting ideas in Judaism today, we as representatives of Reform Judaism in America, in continuation of the work begun at Philadelphia in 1869, unite upon the following principles. Now when they say they unite upon the following principles, it's true. This plank was unanimously adopted. Nobody voted against it. Which is not so easy to pull off, to have a unanimous verdict in a rabbinical conference, but they got it first.
How many were in the attendance?
19.
Was there any outcry from the Orthodox?
Yes, we're going to get to that. There's a major outcry after the fact.
Imagine that.
Yes.
I mean, 19 is Baptist.
Well, there weren't that many Reform rabbis in America at that time.
There
aren't that many rabbis. Okay, first, we recognize in every religion an attempt to grasp the infinite, and in every mode, source, or book of revelation held sacred in any religious system, the consciousness of the indwelling of God in man. We hold that Judaism presents the highest conception of the God idea as taught in our Holy Scriptures and developed and spiritualized by the Jewish teachers in accordance with the moral and philosophical progress of their respective ages. We maintain that Judaism preserved and defended amidst continual struggles and trials under forced isolation this God idea as the central religious truth for the human race.
They do believe in God.
No. All right. I don't say that they don't believe in God. I say they believe in a God idea.
Okay.
I'll explain.
Can you translate
what you just read? What did I just read? So what they did was to say there are many religions out there in the world, and each one of them has some kind of a sacred writ, some book that they hold is a revealed work from some higher power. All right? Now, the very fact that they acknowledge that other religions have these sorts of things is already a diminution of the Torah to be not necessarily on par with the New Testament or the Quran or whatever the Hindus have. But the mere mention of it says that our Torah is, in a way, just like those other books. And although it's like those other books, it's the highest conception of the God idea, meaning ours is better. So however you conceive of the revealed nature of Torah, whether you believe in Mosaic authorship or divine authorship or documentary hypothesis, however your position might be in Revelation, ours is still better than theirs. Okay, there's a certain Jewish pride, a certain chauvinism, Jewish chauvinism here, that our book is better than everybody else's book. Well, it's a foundation of Abrahamic religions, but there are other non-Abrahamic religions that are out there.
Okay. That
we're not getting to that issue just yet. They're going to address it in one of the later points. So the God idea is a way of throwing a bone to those who have a humanistic conception of the deity, who have a Kaplanian idea of God, that there is no personal God, but rather that there is some kind of a vague entity, a process in the world that motivates people to do good.
Spinoza?
There could be Spinozists in this conference, all right? Or things, viewpoints that are similar to Spinoza and are very far removed from the true theism of traditional Judaism. So the God idea means that you could believe in God, and maybe God is real, or you don't believe in God, but God is a human idea that is a good idea. God, good, same thing, okay? Yeah.
So we're talking, this whole conference, this whole discussion is about reform and other Jews.
Yeah.
Was there still a big core, a large core of Orthodox congregations, little shtiblach, and Jews in America at that time?
In 1885, there were some in the eastern seaboard cities because the Eastern European immigration had begun about 4 years earlier. So yes, there were. In 1880, there wasn't much. Wasn't much. Okay, so the other issue here is that Judaism always has the highest conception of the God idea, not just because of some one-shot revelation on Sinai years ago, but that throughout the generations and despite persecution, Jews have been able to maintain the best form of religion in the world. Now, what that says is that in an ideal world, everybody would be a Reformed Jew, even the Goyim. There's a certain universal hope. Okay, there's a desire that everyone should be like us. Now, what's us? Reform Judaism. Yeah.
Isn't that like the deists of our founding fathers?
Very similar to, yes.
The idea of a personal God and then the idea of God for everybody.
For everybody else. Correct. Correct.
But if they're talking about the continuity, the Reform movement is only a relatively new idea.
Uh-huh.
The continuity was going back from the Orthodox.
Their point of view is that Reform Judaism is the contemporary Judaism. We're living in 1885. This is Judaism, and it's better than every other religion.
They don't care about Masorah.
Even
though they're bringing up Masorah.
Continuity in an ever-evolving religion, and the current manifestation is their manifestation. Okay, point number two. We recognize in the Bible the record of the consecration of the Jewish people to its mission as a priest of the one God, and value it as the most potent instrument of religious and moral instruction. We hold that the modern discoveries of scientific research in the domain of nature and history are not antagonistic to the doctrines of Judaism. The Bible reflecting the primitive ideas of its own age, and at times clothing its conception of divine providence and justice dealing with man in miraculous narratives. So let's get to the second half of that first. The miraculous narrative business is to simply say like this: don't trouble us, don't bother us with questions about the veracity of the biblical narrative. However much of it is true, and however much of it is fantastic and fictional, it doesn't trouble us in the least. Why? Because the point of the Bible is to espouse moral lessons, and that it does very well and successfully, and so if there are stories that are beyond the realm of comprehension or the realm of the plausible, let your heart not be troubled, because those things are understandable in a primitive document like the Bible from a long time ago. But the first half of that plank is very important, that the Bible is the record of Jewish consecration as the priest nation of the one God, that collectively we are a mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh. Mamlechet kohanim, it is just as it is the priest's responsibility to officiate the service and to bring people closer to religion, so too it is the nation of Israel's responsibility to bring all of mankind closer to the true faith. And how do we do that? By employing the Bible as our guide in leading everyone in that direction. Okay, number three. We recognize in the Mosaic legislation a system of training the Jewish people for its mission during the national life in Palestine, and today we accept as binding only the moral laws and maintain only such ceremonies as elevate and sanctify our lives, but reject all such as are not adapted to the views and habits of modern civilization. Okay, so it's a pick-and-choose religion. Whatever mitzvot we like, which we think are appropriate for today, we'll keep, and whatever mitzvot we don't think are appropriate for today, we'll say is a relic of yesteryear and doesn't need to be done right now.
When you were talking about the origin of Reform Judaism in Germany,
yeah,
you explained that the theme was we had to simplify the religious practice in order to make it more acceptable to the evolving times,
yeah,
and the demands of the workplace. Or
yes.
Else. That was one theme. In America, the theme seems to have more of an evangelical connection or even a missionary type motivation. Is
so,
that a distinction?
So I would say like this. In Germany, the theologians probably would have wanted that missionary component of Reform Judaism too, but they recognized the absurdity of it in Europe, where everyone hates the Jews, and you're lucky if you get emancipation. There isn't going to be a radical transformation of European society in the direction of a universalized Mosaic faith. Whereas in America, which is a wonderful country where we don't hate the Jews and the Goyim are nice people, and also their religion, which is mostly a Protestant religion, is pretty close to a universalized Jewish church anyway, maybe we'll be able to impact on the wider world. We won't just be a watered-down Judaism for former Jews. We'll be a religion for everybody that can impact the world, or at least our world here in America. Yeah.
It seems like the pro, say, of Palestine.
No, what they're saying here is that there was once national life in Palestine and that the laws of the Torah were appropriate for that moment. In other words, the laws of the Torah are not evil and pernicious and bad. No, the laws of the Torah are good, but for their moment. And their moment has come and gone to a large extent. Whatever, you know.
But they're not addressed in Palestine.
Not yet. Not yet.
They really thought that Protestants would leave their religion and join the fourth Goyish Chicago.
Okay, a lot of this is just highfalutin talk. The bottom line, as Alan has mentioned a few times over the course of this season, heterodox Judaism is just one long descent away from traditional religion. And you dress it up with a lot of complicated theology that doesn't have any hopes of ever coming to fruition.
But in Europe, they're mostly Catholic.
It depends which country. Yeah. Okay, so fourth. We hold that all such Mosaic and rabbinical laws, as regulate diet, priestly purity, and dress, originated in ages and under influence of ideas altogether foreign to our present mental and spiritual state. They fail to impress the modern Jew with a spirit of priestly holiness. Their observance in our days is apt rather to obstruct than rather than further modern spiritual elevation. So what they do here is to say, yes, we've just told you that you can pick and choose based upon what you find spiritually elevating and what you think is a relic of the past. But we're telling you that specific aspects of the halakha and of Torah law are a relic of the past. Meaning, we're not going to leave it up to the layman's choice. We're going to say simply, these things we don't do anymore. And what are they? The kashrut laws, priestly regulation, meaning Kohanic laws, and dress. Now, when they say dress, what do they mean? They mean talis, tefillin, yarmulke, whatever, the bekesha, the kaftan, whatever it is. You're not going to look like an old world Jew anymore. Okay, fifth. Now we get to messianic issues. We recognize in the modern era of universal culture of heart and intellect the approaching the realization of Israel's great messianic hope for the establishment of the kingdom of truth, justice, and peace among men. We consider ourselves no longer a nation, but a religious community, and therefore expect neither a return to Palestine, nor a sacrificial worship under the sons of Aaron, nor the restoration of any laws of the Jewish state. So no Mashiach ben David, no Shivat Sion, no Binyan Beit HaMikdash, no Korbanot, no Medinat Yisrael.
No Israel bonds.
Okay? No Israel bonds, no. You're right. Okay.
That was basically what evolved into the American Council for Judaism.
Yeah. Correct, correct. This particular element of the Pittsburgh Platform survived in the American Council for Judaism with Elmer Berger, the PLO rabbi. Okay, so...
Zionism was still a dozen years away.
Well, there already is Chibat Zion, and they're aware of it. They're aware of a nascent movement in Eastern Europe that are the lovers of Zion. The word Zionism was not coined until 1890 by Nathan Birnbaum, and you don't have a Zionist Congress until 1897, but there already is some murmurings. Okay. Now, what this element of the platform is telling us, aside from the business of no Palestine, no Mashiach, and all that, is that the world is on the verge of becoming a really great place. The world used to be a place of barbarians, and... Where civilization was under threat of tyrannical rule, but lawlessness, chaos. But all of that seems to be behind us now, and we're moving forward towards a glorious human future. In 1885 in America, it's easy to believe that. In 1885 in Europe, in certain countries, you might even believe that if you're a Jew. By 1895, it's harder to believe that because political anti-Semitism is on the ascendancy with Karl Luger and Wilhelm Marr, the League of Anti-Semites, and certainly by the early decades of the 1900s, it's hard to believe that as people are dying by the hundreds of thousands in World War I. World War I destroyed the faith in humanity of a lot of people, also destroyed religion for a lot of people. So in its moment, this made sense. Two generations later, it would make no sense. Now, let's go to point number six. We recognize in Judaism a progressive religion, ever striving to be in accord with the postulates of reason. We are convinced of the utmost necessity of preserving the historical identity with our great past. Christianity and Islam being daughter religions of Judaism, we appreciate their providential mission to aid in the spreading of monotheistic and moral truth. We acknowledge that the spirit of broad humanity of our age is an ally in the fulfillment of our mission, and therefore we extend the hand of fellowship to all who cooperate with us in the establishment of the reign of truth and righteousness among men. In other words, interreligious dialogue is good. Why is it necessary to record that in the Pittsburgh Platform? Well, because historically the Orthodox rabbis were not exactly fans of interreligious dialogue. In medieval times, it was coerced upon them with vikuach, with debates. Where people, the rabbi's hand was tied behind his back, and he couldn't really say what he wanted to say. I mean, in Europe at least, I'll just give you anecdotally, the rabbi emeritus of my shul, Rabbi Weinberger, likes to tell the story about how his father was a rav in some town in Austria-Hungary, and he'd have to meet with the galach every now and then for civic occasions in the 1920s and 30s. And the galach would want to talk. And the Rabbi Weinberger Sr. didn't want to talk, but they'd have to shake hands. He'd wear two pairs of gloves. And when he would go back home, he would take the gloves off and go to the mikveh before davening. So it goes to show that the traditional rabbis were not interested in this sort of thing, and they didn't regard Christianity and Islam as a daughter religion spreading truth and making the world a better place. They regarded the other religions as, if not the enemy, then at least something repulsive. Yeah. No, and in fact, we're going to get to intermarriage in a few minutes. They have a big problem. What is the attitude of the Reform rabbinate towards intermarriage? There are those who oppose it very vigorously, and there are those who oppose it not as vigorously on the grounds of expedience, because they have congregants who they want to officiate and there's money involved. Okay. Now, number seven.
The approach is somewhat different among the Orthodox today.
Yes, in the world today, the great interreligious dialogue is done basically by Orthodox rabbis, not by the heterodox rabbis. I mean, after Heschel's period with Vatican II, the era of big Reform and conservative rabbis dealing with the leaders of other religions ended. And Mordechai Waxman, to an extent, dealt with the Pope. But after that, the major players were all Orthodox rabbis. I'm not 100% sure why, but the rabbinate council in Israel with Shai Yashuv Cohen got heavily involved, especially in making relations between Israel and the Vatican. And then you had other major figures. You had Emanuel Jacobowitz, you had Lord Sachs, you had Rabbi Schneier here in America. I mean, you have, but almost all Orthodox rabbis.
I'm amazed with this Ezra Friedland, who is a personal friend of mine, developed uh-huh. And how he brings the pious rabbis from
yeah.
All the African-American yeah. leaders and the secular and the Catholic.
It's now yeah.
to some extent.
Yeah,
was a good friend. It's politics. It has nothing to do with religion whatsoever. Pure politics.
Right.
That's it.
Could
yeah.
be. All right. Number seven. Number seven. We reassert the doctrine of Judaism that the soul of man is immortal. Grounding this belief in the divine nature of the human spirit, which forever finds bliss in righteousness and misery in wickedness, we reject as ideas not rooted in Judaism the beliefs in a bodily resurrection and in Gehenna and Eden, hell and paradise, as abodes for everlasting punishment and reward. So this is very important. There is no Gehenna and Gan Eden. What is there? Bliss in righteousness and misery in wickedness. Now that's so it doesn't say whether it's in this world or in some hereafter, and it doesn't say that it's imposed by some divine being as reward and punishment. It just says that there is bliss and there is misery. How that comes about, don't ask too many questions. All right? But as much as this is a departure from the tradition, it's actually an affirmation of some religious virtue, in the sense that they could have said, there's the Olam Hazeh, and there's nothing else.
Right.
They could have said that, there's nothing else, like a Sadducean approach. The Sadducees didn't believe in the Olam Haba, or any hereafter for that matter, and they believed in reward and punishment in this world only, which didn't always manifest itself, meaning martyrs sometimes died, you know, righteous martyrs could die, in which case, where is the Sachar V'Onesh? We just don't see it. So this platform says there is an element of Sachar V'Onesh, it's just not in the traditional way. Fine. Eighth. Now we get to the one written by Emil Hirsch, which is different from all the others. In full accordance with the spirit of Mosaic legislation, which strives to regulate the relation between rich and poor, we deem it our duty to participate in the great task of modern times, to solve on the basis of justice and righteousness the problems presented by the contrasts and evils of the present organization of society. Give me another word for that. Socialism, or communism. So, Emil Hirsch was the social justice rabbi before social justice was cool. What is he saying? That everyone else believes the world is becoming better and better and better. We're on the verge of messianic times, of universal human brotherhood and a glorious civilization. What Hirsch is saying is we're far from that. There are many social ills, the gap between rich and poor, the capitalists are exploiting the working class, and we, the rabbis and Reform Judaism, need to do something to stop it. Is that going to go over well with the laity? Most of whom are wealthy industrialists. So the great divide in Reform Judaism is between the rabbinate and the wealthy laity. Now bear in mind, who are the members of the Reform synagogues or temples? Rich people who could afford the dues. And there aren't that many Reform Jews in America. Despite the what you might think today, that you're 10% of Jews are Orthodox and 50% are Reform, whatever. No, there were almost no Reform Jews. There were 250,000 Jews in America at that time, or 300,000 Jews in America, or 350,000 by 1885. How many Jews were members of Reform synagogues? Maybe 20,000, 25,000. Why? Not because everyone else was such a frummy. No. Most of the Jews of the German wave were already assimilated. It's that very few people either could have any interest in this,
right,
or could afford to have an interest in it financially. It's expensive to join a temple. Especially when they have building these big buildings, tall buildings that are imitating churches. It's not a simple thing to join the social elite that is Reform Judaism. And so those who are of that sort made their money and don't want to hear about exploited workers when they're exploiting the workers. So you have, between 1865 and 1885, almost no mention of tzedek tzedek tirdof, justice justice ye shall pursue, social justice.
Just tirdof.
Huh?
Just tirdof.
Yeah. Just tear it up. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So you have the notion that capitalism will float all boats. That's the American way. And that socialism is antithetical to Americanism and to Judaism. That was the viewpoint of the politically conservative Reform rabbis of the earliest period of time. But after this platform in the 1890s and 1900, 1910 and beyond, you have a changeover where the rabbis are pushing the laity on issues of economic justice.
They preached this in
the... So some rabbis did, and sometimes they could lose their job for it. Other times they are effective in convincing their parishioners that, yes, there are social ills that need to be righted. Okay, there you go. All right. So, after this platform was promulgated, what Isaac Meir Wise said, what is it? It's a declaration of independence for Judaism. And what did his detractors say? It's a declaration of independence from Judaism. Felix Adler viciously attacked the Pittsburgh platform as basically being a racist document. Why? Because the first of the eight planks of the platform spoke about Jewish, not chosenness, but the superiority of Jewish religion over all other religions, not on the basis of one absolute divine revelation, which would be excusable in its own right, but on the basis of the claim that in every generation we get it better than the other guys get it.
Yep. And seniority.
Well, seniority is an objective fact, but it's quite another thing to say, putting aside seniority, that in every single generation we always get it better than the goyim do. All right. So, Benjamin Zold, the rabbi of Ohev Shalom in Baltimore, tried unsuccessfully to pull his shul out of the Union of American Hebrew Congregations in protest of the fact that this platform was espoused by Wise and his cohort. The Orthodox and the conservative elements on the East Coast banded together to establish the Jewish Theological Seminary, which we'll speak about at length maybe in about 2 or 3 weeks from now. Wise's dream of a united American Judaism was in shambles, because now the traditionalist factions are going to strongly protest and work against the interest of the Reform movement. So, with this said, we go into the classical period beyond 1885. There are two leading figures, as I said, Kohler and Emil Hirsch, the two brothers-in-law. Kohler was a lifelong religious zealot. He wanted an occidentalized and universalized, but firmly theistic modern Judaism, meaning he believed in God. And he was a religious man. Not religious in wearing tefillin and talis and eating kosher, but, although he might have done some of those things, but personal piety, daily communion with God in real prayer to a truly personal God. He's a believer. Okay? He was a Reformed pietist, very European and not very American, a believer in radical Wissenschaft, and that the moral idea has primacy over the halakha. By contrast, Hirsch was very Americanized, and was only influential in Chicago, where he had his shul, but he had 2,000 members in his shul who came every week to hear him, because he was a great orator. He was very far to the left of Kohler. Hirsch believed in the prophetic heritage, the mission of Israel, and the universal messianic goal. Kohler said the following. Now, if you remember, Claude Montefiore in England said something very similar. He said, "The Bible is holy not because it is inspired, but because insofar as it still does inspire." So it's not whole, it's not inspired.
It's ongoing.
It's holy insofar as it continues to inspire, which means that the authority lays not in the text, but in the reader. In the reader. Okay. Hirsch was a student of comparative religion and explained that Judaic rituals were borrowed from sister civilizations in the ancient Near East, and therefore they've been debunked as divinely commanded rituals. So Hirsch was very hostile to ritual. Kohler, much less so. What about Darwinism? So Darwinism was big in America in the 1880s, 1890s. And the big Reform rabbis had to address the matter. So how do they address it? For Kohler, Darwinism means that there's evolution. Biological, but also spiritual evolution. Hence the need for an ongoing Judaism that is not the same as the Judaism of the generation prior. But rather, something new, something that has continuity to the past, but it is new. For Hirsch, he has a brilliant idea. survival of the fittest. So Judaism, the religion of Israel, is the morally and spiritually fittest of all the religions, and therefore it survived despite persecution. How do you like that? So survival of the fittest, Judaism is the fittest. It survives. Kohler believed in the efficacy of prayer, whereas Hirsch defined prayer in purely human terms. We're not actually petitioning a real God. We're just thinking about our best self. Okay? Kohler was a man of sentiment who later in his life appreciated the value of symbol and ceremony and wanted people to do more ritual in their lives, whereas Hirsch only wanted to stress social justice and no ritual. Their books, the title of their respective books, says everything about their religious point of view. Kohler's book was called Jewish Theology. Hirsch's book was called My Religion. So Hirsch, whereas Kohler wanted to have historical Judaism, although watered down in terms of halacha, Hirsch, his religion really wasn't Judaism at all. It was Emil Hirsch's religion, with 2,000 people listening in the audience. Okay. That he did. But Wook at the time was closer to traditional Judaism than Emil Hirsch ever was. So, in truth, both of these guys were a little bit of outsiders to the Reform establishment. Number one, because they were sons-in-law of Einhorn and everyone hated Einhorn because he was a bit of an outcast. And also because these guys studied in Germany. They didn't study in Cincinnati at Hebrew Union College. And what is Reform Judaism? It is a collegiality associated with being disciples of Isaac Meir Wise and having studied in Cincinnati. Wise was a chacham. Wise knew how to play the game. He established a union of congregations in 1873 and a college in 1875, but he did not establish a rabbinical association until 1889. Why did he wait? He waited for his own graduates to be old enough to join a rabbinical organization in sufficient numbers. So when there were 20 musmachim of Hebrew in college, now it's time, shoin tzeit, to make a organization. All right? So they made him the president, and he was the president for life. He dies in 1900, and he's no longer the president, although he could have been president even after he died. All right. How many Reform rabbis were there in America? So in 1889, there were 20 graduates of Hebrew Union College who formed the CCAR. In 1895, there were 135, and in 1914, there were 200 members of the union. The CCAR was the only one of the three organizations that was founded as a reform body. Remember, the Union of American Congregations was supposed to be all-encompassing. We tried to bring in even the traditionalists. It basically failed at that, but it tried. Hebrew Union College was supposed to not just be a reform seminary, but a seminary that graduated rabbis for American Judaism, however you wanted to define it. But the CCAR was avowedly reformed from the very beginning.
And when there were 200 reform rabbis, yeah. How many Orthodox rabbis were there?
It's hard to know, but the Agudas Rabbanim, which was founded in 1902... they probably have membership roles that I could look up to see how many were in their organization, but there were also people who were not in the Agudas Rabbanim who, for political reasons, for kashrus inspection, didn't want to have anything to do with the Agudas Rabbanim, and there were also musmachim of Reitz who were not allowed in the Agudas Rabbanim, which we'll talk about in about a month, the fight between the American Orthodox rabbis and the ones who came from Europe. So I don't know. There was a substantial number by 1914, a very substantial number. I just don't know off the top of my head how many there were. Yeah.
Very interesting. Aside from the fact that we are a group observant of Orthodox, even if we were not even Jewish, looking in hindsight at how successful or unsuccessful this whole revolutionary movement was, looking at it now,
yeah,
you can't help but have a critical eye and say, like, are you kidding? You thought this was the new faith? You thought this had a life to it?
So the truth of the matter is, not everyone thought that it would be viable in the long run. I think many Reform rabbis throughout the generations, especially pre-World War II, in the classical period, did not really believe that there would be classical Reform Judaism 100 years later. I think they thought this was the religion for their people in the moment, the kind of religion they wanted, the kind of beliefs they truly espoused, and they did not worry about continuity.
But their platform talks about
a universal human brotherhood in the future, a messianic time. Lav Dafka, the existence of a distinct Judaism a century later.
But did they have any lower schools for kids?
Yes, but they didn't teach all that much. We're going to get to in the 1920s and 30s when the Union of American Hebrew Congregations hires a fellow by the name of Emmanuel Gamarin, who is a great pedagogue, and he develops the Reform Talmud Torah system into a much more impressive institution than it had been in the earlier decades.
They have rapid assimilation.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so...
They think that Judaism will disappear, or just that their brand will disappear?
I think that they weren't focused on the future of Judaism. Certainly not Emil Hirsch. Kaufman Kohler, later in his career, as I'm going to say tonight in a few minutes, he does, late in his career, think about preserving Judaism as opposed to the denomination of Reform going forward. And because he worries about Judaism and not Reform, he has to evolve his own thoughts about what's important. Okay, so... Yes, there is that realization at some point. Okay. The big issue that divided the CCAR in the first decade of the 20th century were the two big issues were creed and synod. Question of creed. It's one thing to have a platform. It's quite another to have like a catechism, a creed. Say, this is what we believe in. This and only this. So some Reform rabbis wanted it. Others very strongly opposed it. Kohler and Hirsch and some of the other big shots, they opposed the creed because that precludes further development. It locks you into this is Reform Judaism forever. And the whole nature of Reform Judaism is constantly evolving. So you don't want that. Also, it causes schism because if you don't agree, then you walk out and you form another denomination. And we don't want to have a breakaway. The other issue was synod. What is a synod? What is a synod? So there were synods in Germany in 1869 and 1871 at Augsburg and Leipzig. We discussed them. A synod is a conference that combines the ecclesiastical hierarchy with the lay leadership. It's a joint effort to create official religion that the laity and the clergy accept.
Is that through dialogue?
Through dialogue and voting. Okay, so why the desire for a synod? The answer... at least from the handful of people who wanted it.
Isn't the term the synod? That was a church
term. It's a church term, yes, it's a church term, but it can be applied to Judaism, especially this kind of Judaism. So, but what... Not exactly, because the Sanhedrin was the elite scholars, whereas the synod is a combination of the scholars and the definite non-scholars. Okay, why the desire for the synod? So... some wanted it because it's an alternative to the Zionist Congress claiming to represent world Jewry. There is a world Jewry. We are a people. We might even be a nation, according to the nationalists, the Zionists. But if you reject Jewish nationalism and you respect and want the continuation of Jewish peoplehood or the Jewish group, you need a synod. And what is it? A religious synod of Reform rabbis and Reform laity. Basically, it's a Reform version of Agudas Yisrael. Remember, why was the Aguda founded? The Aguda was founded to be the body politic of Israel. Except that what is the body politic of Israel? Orthodox Jews, not secular nationalists. So from the Reform point of view, what is the body politic of Judaism? Reform Judaism, laity and rabbis. But it never happens. It never gets off the ground. And for the next century, the Union of the American Hebrew Congregations, which becomes the Union for Reform Judaism, remains separate and distinct from the CCAR, the Central Conference of American Rabbis.
You know, the irony there in that statement is that not only with the CCAR, but also with the Rabbinical Assembly in the conservative movement, they are now the big publishers of those two movements.
Uh-huh.
The Union for Reform Judaism and the United Synagogue of, not America anymore, it's
of conservative Judaism,
don't have the publishing.
They hardly exist, the congregational unions.
It's pathetic.
Yeah.
And it's the two rabbinic organizations of each that are publishing most of the major.
Yeah, it's true.
Stuff. And that basically the prayer book.
The prayer book, the Chumashim.
The Bible commentary.
Yeah. Okay, now on the issue of prayer book, the CCAR wanted to have a prayer book for Reform Judaism. But they couldn't just adopt David Einhorn's Olat Tamid while his adversary Isaac Meir Wise was still alive and breathing. That would have been a patron punim to reject Minhag America of Wise and take Olat Tamid of Einhorn. But they wanted a radical prayer book that read left to right, not right to left, and didn't have much Hebrew. So the Union Prayer Book was developed in the 1890s and published in 1894, which was basically like the Einhorn prayer book with a little bit of tinkering on the margins. And the whole point of making a new one was just to not offend Isaac Meir Wise. This prayer book became the accepted prayer book in most or almost all Reform synagogues. In most Reform temples, the Torah was still read in the classical period. In some places, it was just shown to the people. They would do Hagbah or take it out of the Ark, but they wouldn't read it. And in Emil Hirsch's synagogue in Chicago, they abolished the Ark. There was no Torah, no Aron Kodesh Gunish. There was a rabbi with a lectern. That's it.
That's it.
That's it. There was before electricity, so no microphone. Okay. In the 1890s, certain decisions were reached by the CCAR. I mentioned some of them last time. No bris for a convert. You don't need to have circumcision or immersion in a mikveh. So easy conversion. Also, an easy approach to the religious status of children of mixed marriages. This is not to say that they adopted patrilineal descent yet. That would happen in 1983 under Alexander Schindler. But they're on the way. It takes 100 years. But there are stages along the way in the eventual recognition that one parent is enough to make the kid a Jew. Cremation was permitted. Why? Because people were doing it. That's the bottom line. People were doing it, so they allowed it. Okay. The Reform rabbi was a preacher and a teacher. Some like to be called doctor or mister, or even minister, rather than rabbi, because rabbi was something of a dirty term.
Many Reform prayer books don't say rabbi in the reading. They say minister.
Minister, yeah. Minister. Okay. There were munificent salaries paid to some of these guys by wealthy laymen. Some of the rabbis balked at the anti-traditionalism of their congregants, but then again, some congregants balked at the anti-traditionalism of some of the rabbis. It depends upon the shul. In some places, the rabbi was the shegetz. In some places, the president was the shegetz. In Emil Hirsch's shul, actually, as much of a radical as he was, his president wanted to make the high holidays on the nearest Sunday, and he said no. Oh my, yeah. Okay. Now, Kaufman Kohler became the president of HUC in 1903, and he immediately introduced biblical criticism, although, as a pulpit rabbi, he refused to use biblical criticism from the pulpit for his sermons, because he believed, and this is a very interesting idea, that the layman should be taught the Bible as is, and not be have his faith subverted by modern scholarship, but that would-be rabbis need to know the truth, and therefore biblical criticism would be taught in the college.
He never realized the absurdity of that equation.
Well, it's not so absurd if you think about it.
I'm listening.
The logic of it is that those who go into religion for a profession cannot be blind to the accepted truths of the academia. Whereas the layperson who just needs spirituality in life, give them what works, not what will undermine what works.
Not my focus.
Well, not confusion. Confusion. Okay? So there's a measure of hypocrisy here. Yes, I understand that there may be an illogic to it, but there's also a logic to it. All right. He replaced emphasis on Talmud with emphasis on Midrash. Why? Because since they're not going to be great halachists and poskim, but rather they're going to be sermonizers, they're homilists, therefore learn the homiletic literature. But other things he did. He required the students to be pious synagogue goers. You had to actually go to services. If you were going to be a rabbi, you had to be a religious Jew by Reform standards. And God forbid you should express any agnosticism or Zionism, which basically are one and the same. Agnosticism and Zionism equal each other in that environment. So there's no freedom of speech or freedom of expression under Kaufman Kohler's HUC. When he dies and is replaced by Julian Morgenstern, there will be freedom of expression. The students, the boys, will rebel, and they want to have the freedom to say whatever they want to say. Okay. Reform Judaism... Who brought in Heschel, and he saved the scholars from Europe. Yeah. Okay, so what happened to some of these rabbis? Well, after 1885, Reform Judaism changed. It was influenced by the American Progressive Movement and the Christian Social Gospel. The rabbinate was agitating for change, pressuring the laity to do so on matters of economic justice. And sometimes they had success and sometimes they didn't, depending upon the economic tendencies and philosophical beliefs of the leading members. Some Reform rabbis wanted to see a merger with Unitarianism. Oy vey. Rabbi Solomon Sonnenschein of St. Louis considered becoming a galach, considered becoming a Unitarian minister because he was offered a position. Rabbi Solomon Schindler of Boston became an agnostic socialist and left the rabbinate. But he later became a Baal Tshuva, an Orthodox Jew. His successor, look him up on Google after we're done. Solomon Schindler of Boston. His successor in the pulpit, Rabbi Charles Fleischer, also left the faith entirely. So some Reform rabbis took their viewpoints to the logical extreme and left the business and left the faith. Okay, but most Reform rabbis were able to balance a healthy respect for other religions and yet a belief in the primacy and priority of Judaism. So Judaism remains our focus, the best religion out there, even if we respect the Christians and especially the watered-down Protestants.
What about Judah L. Magnus? From Temple Emmanuel to being a mainstay of the Israel?
Okay, all right, so we're going to address him in a moment. I have his name is on the paper here. Okay, in 1912, the CCAR discouraged mixed marriages, but it rejected a resolution saying that rabbis ought not officiate at those marriages. Samuel Shulman, who was the rabbi of Emmanuel, put forth the proposition that rabbis should not officiate at mixed marriages, and it was voted down. Why? Because those who were doing it didn't want to be seen as flouting the norms of their professional guild. So just by saying it's discouraged, it means that lechatchila, it's not a good thing. It doesn't mean that b'dieved, the rabbi can't do it. The rabbi can do it. All right?
It was economically...
It was important for the hachnasa, for the livelihood of the rabbi, to not decline officiating at life cycle events. That's not to say that they couldn't refuse. I'm sure some did refuse. I'm sure plenty of them refused. But it's hard for a heterodox rabbinical group to lay down hard and fast laws that must be adhered to on pain of sanction, because too many of the members are going to go against it, and then you have no union. So you have to not impose these rigorous standards. All right. What about Sunday services? So about 30 congregations in America had Sunday services. That's not to say they had Sunday Sabbath. Let's not conflate the two. It's one thing to have a service on Shabbos, to have a service on Sunday in addition to Saturday, or Saturday but not Sunday, yet Sunday but not Saturday, but the Sunday service be a weekday, a Yom Chol service. The worst of the worst is you don't have Saturday, you only have Sunday, and the Sunday is Yom Shabbos. That's a disgrace. Sunday is Yom Chol, I can understand. Nobody's coming Saturday, they come Sunday. All right. Okay, I'm glad you mentioned it. So the late Friday night service is not an invention of conservative Judaism. It's an invention of Reform Judaism in the 1890s, early 1900s, as a more religiously or Jewishly appropriate alternative to the Sunday service. Meaning if Saturday morning is a lost cause, you got to do something else, and Sunday looks goyish. So Friday night looks Jewish. Do it. Friday night service. And it was very successful in a lot of congregations. Okay. Kaufman Kohler in later years admitted that the Sunday service was a grave error. And with the resurgence of anti-Semitism and the need to preserve distinctly Jewish methods in the face of hostile Gentile world, he said, we made a mistake. There never should have been any Sunday service, only Shabbos, the Jewish Shabbos, that's it. Okay. Reform held little appeal for Eastern European Jews when they came off the boat to America. Truth is, even for the second generation, they held little appeal. It was not until after World War I that the second and third generation of Eastern European Jews were attracted to the Reform synagogue and could afford to pay the dues. But, with all this said, there were Reform rabbis in the classical period, even before World War I, who were espousing viewpoints that became the dominant viewpoint in the neo-reform period after World War I in the 20s and 30s. And who are these rabbis? Well, first of all, on the issue of Zionism. Reform, classical reform, staunchly anti. The neo-reform period, sort of a lukewarm acceptance. So we see this, 1897, the CCAR blasts the Zionist Congress of Basel, Herzl, and says it's terrible. 1917, what do they say about Balfour? It's a nice thing that the Gentile world is showing an appreciation of and support for the Jewish cause. So it's not saying we support Jewish nationalism. It's recognizing that the Goyim did the Jews a favor. Okay.
So Brandeis
became a Zionist, but he became the leading American Zionist. But Brandeis wasn't really a Reformed Jew. He wasn't much of a Jew at all. But who are the leading Reform rabbis who are Zionists? So first of all, Gustav Gottheil of Temple Emmanuel, Judah Magnus of Temple Emmanuel, Stephen Wise, who wasn't going to be at Temple Emmanuel until they tried to check his sermon and he wouldn't comply, and he established a free synagogue. Not free from dues, but free in that the pulpit was free. He could say whatever he wanted without the laity checking the sermon in advance. Also Max Heller, Joseph Krauskopf. There were major Reform rabbis who were Zionists. They were not the majority of their professional guild, but they were enough and big names, very big names from prominent congregations. So Abba Hillel is the next generation, and he's on the scene, and in the neo period he's becomes the leader of the cause of the real Zionists, not the wishy washy ones like Stephen Wise. Okay, in 1907 something else happens. The CCAR establishes a responsa committee, Shilas Uchuvas, halachic literature for the Reform movement. Now, not that these decisions are binding, but they give guidance and advice to Reform rabbis and lay leaders about what Judaism says and what liberal Judaism might say on a given question. The fact that the committee even exists shows that people are now interested in ritual religion. If ritual religion were meaningless, there'd be no responsa committee. Later on, it's become a big deal with Walter Jacobs, Salman Frihoff, Moshe Zamir in Israel. It's a big deal later in the 20th century, but in the early part of the 20th century, it gets off the ground. Jacob Schiff, the rich man, and his buddies, his son-in-law Felix Warburg and other fellow Emmanuel-type Jews, they reestablish JTS in 1901-1902, bring Salman Schechter to America. Why do they do this? Because they recognize that Reform Judaism is not enough in this world. You need to have a traditional Judaism for those from the East who want more tradition, and for whom Reform Judaism is just a joke or beyond the pale. Okay, so Jacob Schiff had an interesting point. He said there can be no healthy Reform that has not its origin in Orthodoxy, meaning Reform Judaism comes from somewhere. It comes from Judaism, meaning Orthodox Judaism. And if Orthodox Judaism dies, there's no Reform either. There's no Judaism. Later on, in the 1940s and 50s, Isaac Klein would say the same thing about conservative Judaism. One of the most prominent conservative Jews and conservative rabbis in America, and the most frum of all the conservative rabbis in America,
he was a posek,
he said, "Where is our enthusiasm, our lifeblood coming from? From the children of the Orthodox Jews, not from the children of the conservative Jews." So big leaders, lay leaders and rabbinical leaders of the heterodox denominations recognize you have to have the survival of a more traditional branch for Judaism to hold on. Kaufman Kohler in his dying days said, "We need to focus on Judaism, not on Reform." Now what did he mean? He didn't mean, you know, pious Hasidism, but he meant that we can't just be partisans for our denomination and say that alone is going to sustain Judaism for the future and that is our only focus, but rather, we want Judaism to survive without denominational labels. We like our denomination the most, but we recognize there is a broader Jewish world out there, and let's work to sustain it, to keep it alive. All right, that's true. Halavai that the conservative leadership today would recognize that as their denomination is on the brink of extinction, they need to use whatever assets they have for the survival of broader Judaism, not so that their various institutions can hold on for dear life. Okay, we'll stop here.